And we're in our Bibles to the book of Proverbs, if you would, please. The book of Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 1. We'll just be looking at the introduction to the book this morning, verses 1 through 7. With the storm this past week, I was reminded that one of the things that you learn very quickly in working with traffic is that people don't like not knowing where they're going. The thing is, it's not just them, it's us. None of us enjoys the experience of going along our way and suddenly finding that our route is broken, that there's a tree in our way, that an accident is blocking the road, that there's wires down. None of us like to have our plans changed in a moment. We have to reroute everything. But rerouting is difficult, but it's less difficult when you have a GPS, but it's more difficult when your GPS isn't there, or you're running out of battery on your phone and all of a sudden you can't plug in where you need to go, reroute, and find that. Wisdom kind of functions like a heavenly GPS, if you will. It provides us the ability to reroute with confidence in the midst of life's paths which are crooked, life's paths which are broken. And they're broken in the world in which we live, and we know that one day all the crooked will be made straight, all the low will be exalted, all the high things will be made low. Those things that stand in the way, God will make straight before us. Our focus this summer is going to be on the book of Proverbs. Our goal during these morning services is to examine the way of wisdom, the way of wisdom. What we're going to look at today is where wisdom begins. Our goal is to examine this way, but my goal this morning is simply to convince you of one thing, that you need wisdom to skillfully navigate the crooked paths of the broken world in which you live. You know that. You've been forced to reroute. You've had road closed. You've had detour signs placed in your life. You've had plans that you've had to change. And you know that sometimes you've responded well. You know that other times that you haven't. And rather than finding your way through the muddled mess of life, you've actually added to it. You've gone the wrong way and you've taken the wrong route. You've made the mess bigger by becoming a part of the pile-on in the accident of life. Proverbs chapter 1, verses 1 through 7 is just the introduction. We don't know exactly who penned this portion of it. It could have been Solomon himself. It may have been the compilers that brought these things together. It says the men of Hezekiah brought together these Proverbs. Regardless, it's from God. It's been preserved for us and handed down to us through God's people from God himself. Proverbs chapter 1, verses 1 through 7. The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. To know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight, to receive instruction in wise dealing, in righteousness, justice, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the youth. Let the wise hear and increase in learning, and the one who understands obtain guidance. To understand a proverb and a saying, the words of the wise and their riddles. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and destruction. As we come to the book of Proverbs, it's important for us to understand where Proverbs fits. So as we've been doing, we're going to try to lay a little bit of the context of where this Proverbs or wisdom literature fits. In fact, the first thing we need to note is that Proverbs fits within a larger genre of wisdom literature. It fits during the time of the ancient Near East. It fits in with other wisdom literatures of the day. Wisdom literature was kind of a genre that was a preoccupation of kings, of courts in the ancient Near East, particularly during times of stability, which makes sense that we would get this then from the hand of Solomon, under whose hand the kingdom was stabilized, it was peace. It was at rest during the entirety of his reign. So this is a genre of literature that deals with life in all aspects, especially court life, and it's a preoccupation of those in the middle ancient Near East
during times of stability. There's Mesopotamian literature from the Sumerians, the Akkadians. There's Egyptian literature. There's Aramean literature. Much of it is reflected and even resounded in the book of Proverbs. It's largely secular, but it's true. And so there's even a large portion of the book of Proverbs which seems to reflect some of this ancient Near Eastern literature, but it comes from a totally different tack in that it comes with a mindset of God behind it. It's important for us to keep in mind 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 29, which says that God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure, and the breadth of mind like the sand of the seashore, so that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the east, even all the wisdom of Egypt. And so in 1 Kings chapter 4, it says that wisdom is a preoccupation of these nations during this time. And Solomon's generous endowment of wisdom exceeded all of the wise nations in their preoccupation with wisdom during that time. So much so that the people of all nations came to hear this wisdom of Solomon, and from all the kings of the earth who'd heard about his wisdom. That helps us to understand just a little bit of the priority that was placed on wisdom in this culture. That kings, they wouldn't send their viziers, they wouldn't send their underlings, they would take up the journey themselves. They would risk the journey to go find out wisdom for themselves. That's why we have the Queen of Sheba, who leaves her kingdom behind in the hands of somebody else so that she can make this grand trek up to Jerusalem to find out what wisdom Solomon has. And she says, it exceeds anything that I've been told or could have imagined. This preoccupation with wisdom. So not only is the book of Proverbs in this genre of wisdom literature within the ancient Near East, but it also fits into Old Testament wisdom literature. It's distinct from law, distinct from prophecy, distinct from history or the Psalms. Wisdom is defined as skill in the art of godly living. What do we mean by wisdom? As we look at what wisdom is, we're going to find that it's intensely practical. It deals with everything in life, from family, to wealth, relationships, character. There's not an aspect of life that isn't touched by wisdom. That means wisdom is supposed to find its way out in every aspect of our life. It's markedly intellectual. It's an exercise in disciplining the mind. It reminds us very much of what Romans chapter 12, verse 2 says. And be renewed in your mind, in your thinking. That's what wisdom is supposed to do. It's supposed to change the way you think. It's rigorous. It's exercising. This is not vegging. So when we come to the book of Proverbs, we're picking up spiritual dumbbells and exercising our minds, learning how to discipline, how to train them in paths that we're supposed to walk. Wisdom has the idea of being somewhat mysterious. That is, it requires revelation in order for us to see behind the scenes. When we come to a wisdom book, whether it's secular or whether it's the book of Proverbs, there's the idea of somebody who's standing at the curtain and pulling back the curtain just a little bit so you can get a peek. Here's what you see, but behind what you see, here's what you don't. So now you can know just a little bit about how life is really working when all you can see is X, Y, or Z. So there's this mysterious element of wisdom literature that requires revelation, a pulling back the curtain so that we can see behind the scenes. And what we find, especially in the biblical wisdom literature, is that wisdom is always moral. It is in other contexts as well, but the morality of the wisdom literature of the Bible is dependent on the character of Israel's God. You be holy because what? I am holy, right? That's what God says. And so there's this aspect of wisdom that falls in line under the character of wisdom's God. That is the God that is, Yahweh, the living God. And so the purpose of wisdom is to live right before God in his world as he made it. That's what wise living is. And so wisdom is the art, skill in the art of living before God in a right way. This genre presents wisdom as dependent on a proper understanding of God and his world. It has to include God at its very center. The book of Proverbs presents kind of general truth that the righteous are blessed and the unrighteous are cursed. In fact, when we come to this genre of literature, there's three books in the Old Testament that fit within this genre. The book of Proverbs, the book of Ecclesiastes, and the book of Job. And they work together. As we come to Proverbs, this is from the Bible Project. I like how they illustrate things sometimes. They did this well. Proverbs has more of the feel of a young teacher. Lady Wisdom, we're going to meet as we walk through the book of Proverbs. She's going to have right advice about everything in life. And the message that she's going to portray basically is this. Live right before God and experience God's blessing. Live wrong before God and experience the hardships of the curse of life. That's the basic overall theme of the book of Proverbs. When we come to Ecclesiastes, we have the sage who's kind of reached the end of his career, and he's looking back more reflectively, more poignantly, and stopping to think about this for a minute, and he realizes, hey, wait a minute. It's not the good guys that are always blessed. Sometimes the bad guys receive blessings. Sometimes the bad guys are successful. This doesn't make sense. I've worked so hard. I've disciplined my life for wisdom, and what do I get? Nothing. Book of Ecclesiastes tempers that and comes down at the end and says, now wait a minute. It's not just life under the sun, but there's life beyond this life that you need to prepare even now to reconcile your life with this God who's transcendent, who goes beyond any boundaries in which we think. The book of Job functions as a literature within this wisdom literature genre. He's the old man. He's the one who's lived a full life. He's already passing the baton on to another generation. And here we see the flip side. Whereas Proverbs says, the righteous are blessed, the unrighteous are cursed. Ecclesiastes says, wait a minute, but good things happen to bad people. Job says, wait a minute, bad things happen to good people. And that's the whole point of the book of Job as he works through this. He says, this doesn't make sense. I can't understand it. Here's what I see, X, Y, and Z. I need somebody to pull back the curtain for me so I can see what's going on behind the scenes. And we get that in chapters 1 and 2. Job doesn't get that ever through the whole book, which we're going to walk through together in our Wednesday night studies this summer. And we're doing that on purpose as we study the book of Proverbs on Sunday morning so that we can see how both aspects of this message is important. What Job comes to the conclusion is that he doesn't necessarily get the why, but he gets the who. That God himself is the source of all wisdom, and because God is who he is, he always operates by this wisdom element that he's incorporated into all of his creation. The specific genre of the proverb is a short sentence founded on long experience, as one writer put it. A short sentence founded on long experience. It presents a general truth that, as Trimper Longman reminds us, a general truth that is situational sensitive. It requires a right reading of people, a right reading of circumstances, a right reading of the times. Let's go up to chapter 26. You're familiar with this example, but it's important for us to get this locked in. So are these proverbs promises? No, these proverbs are general truths that are situation sensitive. So chapter 26, verse 4, and then verse 5. Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. So which one is it? Am I supposed to or am I not supposed to? Applying these truths requires reading the people. What kind of fool am I dealing with? Am I dealing with a fool that I should answer according to his folly, or am I dealing with a fool that I should not answer according to his folly? Let's go up to chapter 29, verse 15. Chapter 29, verse 15. The rod and reproof both give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. Which one does it recommend here, the rod or the reproof? Well, that's what you've got to figure out. So we had one of our children that as soon as we mentioned she was going to get a spanking, wow, you thought the earth was going to crumble. You thought hell was opening up and she was about to drop into it herself. You just had to reprove that one, and all of a sudden, there was a difference. There was a heart change in a moment. There were others, it didn't matter how many times you brought them back, you still had to do it again. Okay? You've got to be able to read life and its situations and its circumstances. Some children need the rod more than others. Not that all don't, but some need it more than others. Some are able to learn with a reproof, whereas others can't. Applying these proverbs requires reading people the right way. Applying these proverbs requires reading the circumstances the right way. Look at chapter 22, verse 15. Folly is bound up in the heart of the child, but the rod of discipline drives it far from him. Now, as I'm thinking about applying corporal punishment to my child, one of the questions I have to ask is this. Did this action come out of immaturity, which is simplicity, the simple? Or did this action come out of folly? That is, a refusal of wisdom. And so, as I'm trying to discern, I will apply less correction for a naive mistake than I will for a foolish choice. Because I'm reading the circumstances. I'm not only reading the child, but I'm reading their motives behind why they did what they did, and something's going to require more intense correction than another form. It requires reading the times rightly. Go back to chapter 12, verse 27. Chapter 12, verse 27. Whoever is slothful will not roast his game, but the diligent man will get precious wealth. He's going to work hard in order to gain wealth. Okay, we see that. Keep your fingers here. Go over to chapter 23, verse 4. Work hard, get wealth. Chapter 23, verse 4. Do not toil to acquire wealth. Be discerning enough to desist. Well, which is it? What am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to discern the times. Is this a time where I need to exercise discipline? Is this a time where I need to stop working so hard and just let God take care of the needs that I can't provide by any amount of work? Psalm 127. They that labor, labor in vain unless the Lord builds the house. Okay? So there's a time to push. There's a time not to push. Ecclesiastes is very indicative of this kind of applying the things to the time. He says in chapter 3, for everything there's a season, a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up, and so on and so forth. I have to, as I'm applying these proverbs, read people, read circumstances, read times. They're not promises. They're general truths that we need to learn to apply in the right ways. The proverb fits within a larger genre of wisdom literature. Biblical wisdom, then, is illustrated by two primary... Well, this is probably important for us to talk about just for a second. The word here is chokmah, and it has the idea of... It's translated wisdom, but it's more than just wisdom. It's the way God made the world. This is a needle and thread. This is the hand of God. Chokmah is what is woven throughout all of God's creation. It's the way the world works. Works by design as an extension of God's character. And so when unbelievers make astounding advances in technologies and are able to benefit human life, they've tapped into chokmah. They've tapped into the way God makes the world and allows the world to work. So as we pursue what wisdom is, what we're actually doing is we're tapping into the way God made the world so that it operates by his wisdom, by his character, even by his power. The context, Proverbs fit within the larger genre of wisdom literature. Biblical wisdom is illustrated by two primary examples in the Old Testament, characters. Both of these characters are presented in a uniquely positive light. Their dark side is withheld from us. Both are given extremely complicated circumstances to navigate, and both become examples of the righteous receiving a just reward. You're familiar with these two examples. The first is Joseph. We don't have almost none of a negative anything happening in Joseph's life. The other is Daniel. Again, he's only presented in such a way that we see how wise living looks. But Joseph, as you read through the book of Proverbs, we come to chapter 5, we come to chapter 7, we come to chapter 9, we see that one of the things that the father is talking to his son about is avoid the wrong kind of woman, the strange woman. She's personified as woman folly in chapter 9. As Joseph lives out this wisdom, this biblical wisdom, this chokmah that God has built into his creation so that it functions the way it's supposed to function by design, Joseph is confronted by Lady Folly, personified in the person of Potiphar's wife. And as he says no because there's a God to whom he answers and he can't do it. In the end, he ends up being thrown into prison, but then he's brought out of prison so that he rules the entire country. He's promoted. He lives right. He receives reward. Daniel demonstrates God as the source of true wisdom. Daniel starts to go through, and there's many different reasons that are offered for why did he refuse the king's meat. It seems later in the book that he's eating the king's meat. So it probably wasn't just a kosher conviction. But what he sets up is he puts himself in a place where he gets meager rations and only God can be the explanation for why he and his companions are flourishing the way they're flourishing. Chapter 1, he's put to the test. God comes through. They're promoted. But chapter 2, then all of a sudden, Nebuchadnezzar has this dream. And not only wanting to know the interpretation of it, he demands of his wise men what the dream itself is. Well, nobody can have that. The wise men get together and say, King, you're being unreasonable. Nobody can have that unless they have access to the gods. The king's sitting there saying, that's what you guys said you have, right? You have access to the gods? Yeah, but they don't function according to our bidding. We don't have that kind of access to the gods. Daniel asks for a little bit of time. He's given it. He goes back to sleep, and he gets an answer that only God can give. And when he comes and stands before Nebuchadnezzar, he says, Nebuchadnezzar, I want you to understand something. The wisdom that I have isn't from me, because nobody can do this, not me, not anybody. But there is a God in heaven who gives wisdom. And I want you to understand, it's he who's pulled back the curtain so that you can see behind X, Y, and Z. And so Joseph and Daniel become these illustrations of wisdom as it's played out in the Old Testament. And it's important that there's nothing bad said about them. We only see how this wisdom plays out for good. But they aren't the primary exemplification of what wisdom looks like. Jesus Christ is the full embodiment of wisdom. Now, for a long time, Proverbs chapter 8 has been associated with the person of Christ, though it's been associated with much caution, because in chapter 8, verse 22, the verb there can be translated that wisdom was created as one of God's work. That is, wisdom then would not be eternal. And Jehovah Witnesses love to jump on this and say, see, if Jesus is equated with wisdom, then God created Jesus. Because back in Psalm or Proverbs chapter 8, he created wisdom. The ESV translates the verb in verse 22 as possessed. It's probably even better translated, as the footnote notes, as fathered. That is, God generated, not created, but passed on the very substance, the very essence of himself, wisdom. He brought forth, he established. See, wisdom didn't start when God created it. It's an attribute of God, so it has to be as eternal as God is. If it's a part of what God is, it has to be as long as God is. But when God creates the world and brings forth the world, one of the very first things he builds into creation itself is the very character of his wisdom. And he weaves it, he establishes, he orders wisdom right into the very foundations of how the world itself works. Christ's earthly life is uniquely marked by godly wisdom. As a child, he's at the temple. He's interacting with the wise men of the Pharisees, probably the Sanhedrin, the 70 wisest men in all the nation. And he's asking them questions, and it says they were amazed at his understanding. How does this kid have this kind of intellect to be able to put these themes together? In chapter 2, verse 52, he increases in wisdom. During his preaching ministry, they're asking, where did this man get these things? Where did he get this wisdom? In Mark chapter 6, verse 2. In his preaching style, he utilizes parables. In fact, it says he did not speak without using parables. The word parable is the Greek translation of the Hebrew word for proverb. Jesus was a wisdom teacher when he spoke. Jesus was weaving the wisdom of the way the world works into his very teaching and calling people to submit themselves to this understanding of God and his world. His wisdom is meant to conceal in Matthew 13, and later in the chapter it's meant to reveal. He conceals and reveals by wisdom. But probably the greatest aspect of wisdom comes out as Jesus is talking in Matthew chapter 12, verse 42. He says, understand, back in the day, Queen of Sheba comes from the south, comes north, comes all the way up to Jerusalem to find out wisdom of Solomon. She's amazed by it. But I want you to understand something. One greater than Solomon is here today. If Solomon is known for his wisdom, what particular attribute is Jesus more significant than Solomon in? It's his wisdom, right? And Jesus says, yes, I have even more than that. As Paul talks about Christ, he states that Christ is the unique expression of what godly wisdom looks like. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1:30, he says, Christ became wisdom to us from God. He's the embodiment of wisdom. He's the fullest expression of what wisdom looks like. Colossians 2, in him are hidden all the treasures of wisdom. So as we read Proverbs chapter 8, are we reading Christ into it? It's probably not the best thing to do, but probably a better way for us to understand it would be for us to understand the Holy Spirit in Proverbs chapter 8. Because it's the Spirit of God who administers the presence and the power of God. It's the Spirit of God that reveals and accomplishes the purposes of God. It's the Spirit of God that energizes and animates all of creation. And so the Spirit is the one who's animating everything from atoms to weather patterns. It's the Spirit of God that allows lights to light. It's the Spirit of God that enables creation to function by design. And Jesus is the embodiment of wisdom within God's creation because, specifically because, he himself is energized and animated by God's Spirit. Go to Isaiah chapter 11 for just a second. Isaiah 11, verses 1 and 2. There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, a branch from his roots shall bear fruit, and the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him. Well, what does that look like? The very first phrase. This is the spirit of wisdom and understanding. This is the spirit of counsel and might. This is the spirit of knowledge and the spirit of the fear of the Lord. When we come to Proverbs chapter 1, verses 1 through 7, we'll see that these things are exactly what wisdom is. It's wisdom. It's chokmah. It's God's character. It's God's attribute woven into the very fabric of creation itself. It's understanding. And he wraps it up in verse 7 by saying, it's manifest primarily by the fear of the Lord. This comes only by God's Spirit working in those that he gives this wisdom to. So it's important for us to understand that as we come to this book of Proverbs, where it fits. Now, there's three characteristics of biblical wisdom that we want to look at very quickly in these first seven verses of the book as it opens up for us. The first is this. Wisdom is the unique perspective of God's people. We want to look at the covenant context of wisdom. When we're talking this perspective, we're talking about a worldview. The way that we look at life, the way we look at reality, the way the world works. And what wisdom does is it provides us a worldview. But the book of Proverbs has a worldview that it assumes it doesn't create. This spring, we were working through the apologetics course with Ravi Zacharias. We looked at there are four basic questions that every worldview has to address, right? The question of origin, where did I come from? The question of meaning, why am I here? The question of morality, what should I be doing? What ought I to be doing? And the question of destiny, where am I going? We also saw that the biblical worldview answers these facets of our universe that other worldviews don't answer. These become troubling to a secular worldview. Number one, this universe had a beginning. Number two, this universe is finely tuned for life. Number three, this universe operates at highly regular intervals, whether it's a 24-hour day, a 365-day year, or so on and so forth. There's a high measure of regularity. Number four, it's knowable through observation, through experience. Where did cognition, self-awareness, where did that enter into this matter and energy? And finally, there's a morality that's built into creation itself. Every one of us, humanity in particular, operates with a conscience and an expectation of justice. Where did that come from? That's more than just matter. As the book of Proverbs puts together its worldview, it assumes a worldview, and this is the worldview from which it operates. It operates with a view of the world that sees all of reality as a single reality. This is a universe. It all falls under one creator. Therefore, it all operates under his control, by his rules. There's nothing outside the purveyance of God's sovereignty. Number two, this universe is uniquely created by, dependent on, and responsible to a God who's alive and real. It doesn't defend it. It doesn't explain it. It just presumes this in its worldview. Number three, this living God has revealed himself and his will to his creation. Number four, despite rejecting his will, this creation remains sovereignly ordered by the living God who created it. So even though we said no, God is still controlling every aspect of life. Number five, this living God is working to redeem this rebel world. And he's renewing his fallen creation. He's still at work inside the world. Number six, though we can't fully know this God, both God and his creation are knowable to fallen humanity. Yes, through observation, yes, through experience, but even more so by revelation. We need God to be the one who pulls back the curtain so that we can see behind and see, oh, when this is happening, there's so much more. And so God is doing the revealing, and that's what the book of Proverbs is presuming. Number 7, humanity must submit to God's knowable yet mysterious ordering of his creation. He calls his people into covenant. As we look at the Old Testament, there's two covenant responses. You can either obey or you can disobey. Those are the only options that you have. Obedience is equated with loving God. Disobedience is equated with hating or rejecting God. Different parts of the covenant. Obedience is driven by faith. Disobedience is driven by fear. Exodus chapter 32, right after the Ten Commandments. Why did they build a golden calf? Because they didn't know what would happen to Moses, and they wanted to stay in control of the situation. Disobedience is governed by fear. Obedience is always governed by faith. Here's the big thing. Obedience is always characterized as wisdom. Disobedience is always characterized as folly. This is the covenant context of wisdom literature. Obedience, love, faith, and wisdom always, always, always lead God's people to blessing and life. Disobedience, that is rejecting or hating God, fear in a negative way, folly, always, always, always leads to the curse or death. That's the worldview that the book of Proverbs presumes. It gives us this presumption of its worldview up in verse 1. The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. This is the context of the wisdom literature that this book is going to present. Israel, that is, the chosen people of God, redeemed and blessed. Exodus chapter 6. But not just Israel, but David, God's chosen servant. That is, 1 Samuel 13, verse 14, a man after God's own heart. A leader of his people. But then, not just David, but Solomon. Solomon, who is God's chosen sovereign, his name, he's named by his dad Jedidiah, which means beloved of the Lord, and in his time he shall know shalom, peace. Shalomen, Shalomen, the Prince of Peace. Solomon is uniquely the beloved of the Lord, the son of David, meant to rule the people of God. That's the covenant context of this wisdom of God that we're given here in verse 1. Wisdom is the unique perspective of God's people, but number 2, wisdom is the unique purpose of God's people. Look at verse 2. Why did he write this? To know. Verse 2b, to understand. Verse 3, to receive. Verse 4, to give. To know what? Well, to know is to experience the knowledge. It's to demonstrate skill in the knowledge. And the first word that's given to us is wisdom, this chokmah, this creative force that's woven by God into his universe. How does the world work? I want you to know how the world works, always. Because great is his faithfulness. Because big is his character. Because great is his steadfast love toward us. I want you to know wisdom. I want you to know instruction. The idea here, it refers to training, especially discipline, which always includes correction and sometimes includes punishment. And so we find the admonitions about the rod and the rebuke and so on and so forth. He says, I want you to understand, that is to grasp, these words of insight. It has the idea of perceiving through the senses. So it's not just looking at, but looking through. The next little part helps us to see verse 3, to receive instruction in insight. The word here has the idea of comprehension, perception. The idea is to recognize the true nature of things. So seeing behind the scenes, what's really happening here, and the whole purpose of seeing in this way is so that I can respond in the proper way to be successful at this juncture in life, at this detour in life, at this crooked part on life's path. He says in verse 3, to receive instruction in this wise dealing, successful dealings, so that I can receive instruction in righteousness, justice, and equity, or fairness. He says here that wisdom is a moral reality. Wisdom itself is an ethical pursuit. This is not something that you can say, hey, I think I'll do that, or you know what? I don't think that's for me today. He says, if you miss out on this pursuit, you're going to miss out on righteousness. If you miss out on pursuing wisdom, you will miss out on justice. You will not be able to deal with God rightly. You will not be able to deal with man rightly. And Jesus grew in favor with God and man. Righteousness and justice. You won't be able to deal fair in life. You won't give yourself a fair chance. You won't give others a fair chance. You will operate by what is not true, but rather by what is false. Remember the context, just before there was a king. There was no king in Israel, so what did everybody do? Every man did what was right in his own eyes. The book of Proverbs says, listen, folks, unless you take this and put on God's eyes, so you learn what right is, all you have is to be able to do what's right in your own eyes. Well, how does that work for you? Traffic jam. Multi-car pileup, road closed. Okay, you can't go there. And so he says, this is the purpose. This is the unique purpose of God's people. You have to understand the way God's world works, especially as one who belongs to God. That's what God created you for, so that he can bring glory to himself through you. He says in verse 4, to give prudence to the simple. The idea of giving is to provide something that one doesn't possess on their own. This is the transmission of truth from a source outside of oneself. You can't get truth by sitting and conjuring it up on your own, by thinking deep thoughts all by yourself, by being meditative, by being woke. You'll not arrive at truth by your own self. You have to be given truth. You have to be told it. You have to be instructed in it. And so he says to give prudence to the simple. The simple, he says in the second stanza here, or the second line, simple knowledge, discretion to the youth. The idea of one who is simple is those who are naive, uncommitted. They don't know what direction they're going yet in life. In fact, there's three levels, general levels of those who are unwise in the book of Proverbs. The very most innocent level of the unwise is the simple one. It's a child. It's a childishness. It's the immature. It's true of all youthfulness or inexperience. It's a helpful category as parents to distinguish, is this immature or is this foolish and bad, requiring correction or needing punishment? But the whole point of the simple is it emphasizes there's always a hope for change. The simple can be changed so that they can learn wisdom. The second level of unwiseness in the book of Proverbs is the fool. This is the one who rejects wisdom. This is a transitional phase between the simple and the scoffer, which is the worst character in Proverbs. The main feature emphasized by the fool is that there's little hope for change. He's making choices. He's thinking thoughts that become words, words that become actions, actions that become characters, character which is determining his destiny, but he's not down at destiny yet. He's in the habit-forming part of life, the character-building part of life. He's a fool. And it's not that he has no hope, but the more choices that he makes apart from wisdom, he's lessening his chances of change. The worst degree of folly or of unwiseness in the book of Proverbs is the scoffer. In chapter 9, verses 7 and 8, the scoffer is the one who opposes wisdom. He hates and abuses those who try to correct him. In chapter 13, 1, he doesn't listen to those who correct him. In chapter 14, verse 6, he seeks wisdom in vain. In chapter 15, verse 12, he looks for wisdom in all the wrong places. In chapter 21, verse 24, the scoffer is characterized by arrogance. You can't tell him what to do. Haughtiness. Pride. He's wise in his own eyes, is the idea. In fact, chapter 24, verse 9, It says that the scoffer represents the very worst of the human condition. It says the scoffer is an abomination to humanity because he lives by what's right in his own eyes and nobody will tell him what to do. He'll do it his way. And so the point emphasized in the scoffer is that there's no hope. There's no hope for change. And so the whole point is that catching them early, training them so that they're wise. He says there in verse 5, not only is he targeting the simple, but he's also targeting the wise. That is the mature. This is the wise person is the one who increases in wisdom. You would think if anybody in all of creation, in all of history, who did not need to grow in wisdom, it would be Jesus Christ. But twice, toward the end of chapter 2 in the book of Luke, it says, and he increased in wisdom, which means he himself is wise, is wise. In fact, it's going to say in, chapter 3 or chapter 4? Chapter 7, chapter 4, verse 7. The beginning of wisdom is this. Get wisdom! If you would be wise, you want more wisdom. You know that you don't yet have enough. And so as he targets the very beginning, he says, listen, I'm talking to the simple, the ones who can still change, the ones who are still in the portion of life where they're building habits, they're making choices, they're building character. I want to make sure that we're bending you the right direction. And for those of you who are already wise, I want to create a thirst in you for more of God's wisdom. Last point very quickly, because we're moving to communion, and this has to lead us to Christ, because it does. Number 3, wisdom is the unique privilege of God's people. Tremper Longman writes, verse 7 is of this prologue, the final verse is the climax. It's been called the motto of the book. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. It ever bother you? Ever stop and wonder, how is the fear of the Lord the beginning of knowledge? How does that operate? When you fear something, you act in your best interest with regard to what you value most. I remember when I was going up the stairs as a young child, I did not want to go upstairs in the dark. My mom said, it's time to go get your PJs on. I'm crawling up the stairs backwards, kind of whining, kind of crying. I said, do I have to? No, don't do that. You do that. Dad goes outside in the dark, knowing that there's a doorbell, one of those old doorbells, that is positioned right halfway up the stairs. And as we're crawling up the stairs backwards in the dark, no, don't make me do it. Dad goes, brrr! All of a sudden, run down the stairs, grab mom. We were afraid. We were afraid, and in our fear, we acted in our best interest by what we valued most. Life! Mom! Security! What the Bible is saying with by the fear of the Lord is, listen, I want you, go back to Exodus chapter 32, because you have to get the context when the fear of the Lord is introduced as a motive for God's people. Exodus chapter 20, verse 18. They're at the mount, it's shaking, it's smoking, it's thundering. Verse 18, and all the people see the thunder and the flashes of lightning, the sound of the trumpet, the mountain smoking, and the people are afraid. They're trembling. And they're standing far off, and they said to Moses, you go, you speak to us. We'll listen. Just don't let God speak to us, or we're going to die. But verse 20, Moses said to the people, do not fear. For God has come to test you so that the fear of him may be for you so that you may not sin. What's he saying? Don't fear, but be afraid. He's saying, don't be terrified and paralyzed, but be motivated by this God to act in your best interest and understand that he is your best interest. He wants to impress you with his bigness, his largeness. And the choices that lie before you are huge. Their life and death matters. So come now to get an understanding of your God that he's real, he's alive. and that it is in your best interest to act in light of him. Because, as Proverbs says here, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. There is no wisdom apart from a proper view of God. There's no wisdom apart from a proper attitude toward God. There's no wisdom apart from a proper relationship with God. There's no wisdom apart from proper submission to God. If I have those things in place, I can get wisdom. But fools, they despise wisdom because of an improper view of God, an improper attitude toward God, an improper relationship with God, a refusal to submit. Wisdom is not primarily an intellectual commodity. Wisdom is a moral venture. That's why wisdom is only possible for those to whom God has revealed himself. And my friend, God has revealed himself in his wisdom through Jesus Christ. Only Jesus fully realized the wisdom of God. We read Isaiah chapter 11. The Spirit of the Lord rests on him, this Spirit of wisdom, the Spirit of the fear of the Lord. That's why in Hebrews chapter 12 it says, we have to keep our eyes on him. Let us run with endurance the road, the path, the race that's set before us. Well, how can we do this successfully? By looking unto Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despised the shame, and is seated on the right hand of the throne of God. My friend, you need wisdom. Whatever age, whatever stage, whatever gender you are, you need wisdom to navigate, to skillfully navigate the crooked paths of this broken world in which you live. And to do so, you have to follow Christ on this path of wisdom, because he'll never lead you wrong. He'll always lead you the right way.